Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Fort Davis business owner aims to change local alcohol sales laws, by Big Bend Sentinel. Local businessman Roy Hurley, owner and operator of Harvard Hotel and H.E. Sproul Ranch, is reigniting the perennial issue of alcohol sales in Fort Davis, bringing back a petition effort to unify the rules of alcohol sales in Jeff Davis County. Hurley is asking for Jeff Davis County registered voters to sign a petition to change current local alcohol sales laws, intending to put the cause on that November ballot. In order to get on the November ballot, Hurley's petition must gain 409 signatures, equivalent to 35% of all people who voted in the last gubernatorial election. Only registered voters of Jeff Davis County will be counted as valid signatures, and the businessman has 60 days to collect the signatures. The Fort Davis Chamber of Commerce has filed for the same initiative twice in the past, both failing to meet the required signatures to succeed. We had a tough time in 2020 getting signatures because everyone was in quarantine and local mandates restricted us from going directly to the voters' doors, said Melissa Henderson, Chamber Director. This is an important initiative to our small business owners. All businesses should have equal rights to sell alcohol at their establishment if desired. Please sign the petition and vote in November to change our antiquated laws on alcohol sales. Currently, the right to sell alcohol is divided among precincts in Jeff Davis County, with businesses in some portions able to sell, while others down the road that fall in another precinct are not allowed to sell alcoholic beverages. Hurley's aim is to unify the county's liquor laws, legalizing all alcohol and mixed beverage sales in all four precincts of Jeff Davis County. Signatures must be signed by individuals in person. According to the chamber, the petition is available to sign at the Harvard Hotel and the Fort Davis Chamber of Commerce. For a signature to be valid, it must be accompanied by the signer's printed name, the signer's date of birth, the signer's address, and the date of signing. Alpine moves to rescind ordinance that fines trains for blocked crossings, by Stephen Paulson. Officials and residents in Alpine have long complained that Union Pacific Park trains through the center of town, disrupting traffic and hindering emergency response. Last year, after deciding discussions with the company were going nowhere, the city adopted an ordinance to fine the company if it blocked 5th Street in the center of town for more than 15 minutes. Union Pacific did pay the city at least $17,000 in fines, but then, in September, the company sued. As a national train business, Union Pacific said Alpine had no business fining it or telling it what to do. The city pushed back, arguing its ordinance was narrowly tailored to fix a specific local problem dealing with local traffic and safety concerns caused by railroad operations at a single crossing. The lawsuit has dragged on in federal court for months. Lately, though, the lawsuit hasn't been going well for Alpine City Manager Eric Zimmer. A federal judge has repeatedly ruled against the city, including throwing out motions to dismiss in January. Meanwhile, Alpine has also dismissed its former city attorney, Rod Ponton, as officials grew frustrated with how Ponton was handling a dispute between city and county law enforcement. Union Pacific also has a new community relations official, which city officials hope will be more understanding to their traffic concerns. And so, after just around a year on the books, Alpine is moving to overturn its blocked crossing ordinance and go back to discussions with the company. At a city council meeting on Tuesday, city officials voted to start the process of repealing it. At the start of Tuesday's meeting, Sandy Wilson, the new city attorney, gave a pessimistic outlook on the lawsuit. "I did a lot of research," Wilson said. "I've come to find out that the federal government preempts anything with any type of city ordinance regarding any kind of blocking of the roadways. Those legal precedents have been established since 2005, she said. In 2001, a case in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals against the Kansas City Southern Railway Company set the bar on those issues, she said. That case, federal judges ruled that regarding blocked crossings could affect train operations and therefore were outside the authority of local officials. Subsequent laws, including updates to the Federal Railroad Safety Act in 2005, totally took away any power from states to do any type of regulation, Wilson said. Even though Texas still has a state railroad commission, the commission's primary focus is oil and gas, and they do not deal with railroad issues. All of which meant, Wilson explained, that Alpine's ordinance is not enforceable at all. My request is it needs to be repealed by the city, Wilson said. It's not going to be enforceable. With the lawsuit from Union Pacific still ongoing, Wilson said she was now trying to find a way to end the lawsuit quickly and amicably. My goal is to get absolutely no attorney fees charged, Wilson said. In lawsuits, cost of lawyers are typically paid for by the losing side, another aspect of the lawsuit that could prove to be a headache for Alpine. Reached for comment on Tuesday before the council meeting, a spokesperson for Union Pacific said they were continuing to communicate with the city, but the spokesperson stopped short of saying whether Union Pacific would drop its lawsuit if Alpine rescinded its ordinance. We remain engaged with the City of Alpine and look forward to hearing the outcome of the upcoming city council vote, that spokesperson Elizabeth Graham said. Our goal is to collaborate with city leaders to find potential solutions, and rescission of the ordinance will allow us to do that going forward. Rescinding the ordinance will work much like passing the ordinance. After a first reading and vote, which passed on Tuesday, the city will then need to have a second vote. That will likely happen at the next meeting on March 17th. It remains to be seen what will happen to Union Pacific's lawsuit, and much less to train-related traffic issues in Alpine. But like other city officials, Wilson said she had a good feeling about Raquel Contreras, the new community relations liaison at the company. She's willing to come down here, Wilson told the council. We plan on meeting at the railroad tracks. With the coronavirus pandemic still ongoing, Contreras was still waiting on authorization to travel for work, Wilson said. But when she does arrive, city officials could show her the disruptions that happened when Union Pacific parked its trains across Fifth Street. And just maybe Alpine will be able to get the blocked crossing issues resolved that way. As Texas faces internet battles on horizon, partnership aims to map connectivity in Tri-County, by Stephen Paulson. Texans lag behind the rest of the country when it comes to who has quality internet in their homes. Only around 68% of Texans have residential broadband, the term for internet connections with at least 25 megabit per second download speeds. That's behind 33 other states and DC, and below the national average of around 71%. On top of that, Texas is one of only a handful of states without an office dedicated to improving high-speed internet for residents. We don't have a broadband office, said Jennifer Harris, the state director for Connected Nation, a nonprofit group that studies and advocates for improved internet access. There's no state plan, there's no grant program. While other states spend millions on internet infrastructure each year, Texas, she says, spends zero. As the 2021 Texas legislative session continues, Harris is part of a group of advocates who are pushing to change that. On Tuesday, Harris met virtually with local leaders, including those with the Rio Grande Council of Governments and the Tri-County Broadband Alliance, to talk about improving internet connectivity in the Big Bend. One of their top goals is a new survey which aims to provide a down-to-the-mailbox map of who has reliable and affordable internet and who doesn't. The surveys, which are broken down for each of the three counties, are available online at www.myconnectedcommunity.org/Presidio County for Presidio County residents, www.myconnectedcommunity.org/Brewster County for Brewster County residents, and www.myconnectedcommunity.org/Jeff Davis County for Jeff Davis County residents. At the meeting on Tuesday, advocates say they're also working on getting paper copy surveys available to those who don't have internet at all. Like school funding in 2019 and immigration in 2017, internet access and connectivity look to be a major part of the 2021 Texas legislative session. Governor Greg Abbott has named broadband access as an emergency item for this session. At the meeting, advocates say their survey would help state policymakers and businesses get a sense of internet needs in the Big Bend, and would also show that there's money to be made in these investments. The survey comes as Texas faces possible problems for the future of its telecommunications network, particularly in sparsely populated areas. Faced with failing funds, the Texas Universal Service Fund in January cut subsidies for companies working to install and maintain telecommunications infrastructure across the state by more than 50%. In response, around 50 companies, including BBT, sued the state's Public Utility Commission, arguing regulators weren't doing their job to ensure the fund stayed solvent. Meanwhile, the pandemic has students and employees across the state working from home, proving, advocates say, that quality internet is a necessity for modern Texans. The pandemic has definitely highlighted the importance, Harris said. It's pretty evident to most people if they don't have the speeds to do video calls. At the start of Tuesday's meeting, advocates with Connected Nation, including Community Tech Advisor Stu Johnson, defined broadband and explained why it's important to residents and businesses. While measurements of megabit speeds may not mean much to people, broadband is the basic internet connection necessary to participate in many everyday online activities, Johnson explained. Broadband connections can handle 3 to 5 internet-connected devices without issues. It's fast enough for video calls and is fast enough to service online-facing businesses. For some perspective, a typical broadband connection can download a 2-gigabyte file in about 11 minutes. That's roughly the size of a medium-quality feature-length film. Johnson also outlined some of the many ways that broadband connections can improve people's economic outcomes. Each household broadband connection, he said, is worth around $1,800 in value. That's because, in the 21st century, internet connections can be used for basically everything. Broadband can reduce household expenses by allowing people to shop online, attend telemedicine appointments, or work from home, saving workers an average of about $500 a year in fuel and car maintenance expenses, Johnson said. It allows businesses to process transactions and better handle social media accounts. Quality internet is so important to modern life, he explained, that just giving a home access to a broadband plan can raise home values by more than 3%. As a nonpartisan group, Connected Nation has no opinion on how Texas gets to a point where all Texans have access to broadband, Johnson said. But the group was nonetheless dedicated to helping Texans get adequate, affordable, and reliable broadband service, including by collecting data on which communities are serviced by broadband and which are not. Not long ago, policymakers viewed broadband as a luxury, he said, but now, especially with the pandemic, we've seen its truly critical infrastructure. Other advocates at the meeting highlighted what improved internet connectivity would mean not only for the Tri-County, but across the state. Robert Halpern, a member of the Tri-County Broadband Alliance and a workforce and economic development specialist at the Rio Grande Council of Governments, said that rural Texans accounted for about 90% of all state residents who didn't have broadband access. That's us, Halpern said. The pandemic, he noted, has revealed gaps in our digital connectivity out here, with students at area schools sometimes relying on hotspots and other access points just to do basic schoolwork. Harris, the Texas state director, said Texas was lagging behind other states when it comes to improving internet connectivity for residents. Puerto Rico has a state broadband plan, she joked, and they're not even a state. It was past time, she said, for Texas to develop the same. The reduction in subsidies for telecommunications infrastructure doesn't just hurt consumers. It also hurts companies that rely on those funds for projects, said Rusty Moore, the general manager and chief operating officer for BBT, a company that provides such services in West Texas. BBT is doing okay for now, Moore said. We run pretty lean. But he said the subsidy cuts are already having impacts on other smaller businesses across the state, which are having to halt projects and hiring. And if the Texas Universal Service Fund doesn't become more solvent, you've got a disaster waiting to happen, he said. One reason for the fund, he said, is to keep our rates in parity with our metropolitan neighbors. In big cities like San Antonio, telecom providers might have thousands of customers per square mile. BBT, on the other hand, has 0.25. It takes 4 square miles to make one person, Moore said the company's customer base, which is spread out throughout the remote Texas borderlands. Without subsidies to help get service to far-flung areas, some rural customers could be saddled with internet bills 3 times higher than they are now. This isn't just about internet, Moore stressed. The telecommunications networks in rural areas also service devices like cell phones, but with only certain types of customers paying into Texas Universal Service Fund, most notably those with landlines, the fund isn't seeing the cash flow it did in the past. That's one major reason why it's going broke, and why companies like BBT are suing to demand state regulators keep it solvent. Ideally, Moore said, all telecommunications users would pay into the fund, but in the meantime, BBT saw little option but a lawsuit. It was the last thing we wanted to do, filing suit against the Public Utilities Commission, Moore said. We've always had such a good relationship with them. At Tuesday's meeting, Johnson, the community tech advisor, showed a map from Bastrop County demonstrating the reliability of people's internet connection. The map was color-coded for complaints like speed is too slow, price is too high, or data caps limit my ability to use the internet. The goal of this tri-county survey is to provide similar data for the Big Bend. Connected Nations hopes to complete the survey by May, Johnson said, before organizing the data over the summer. Then the group hopes to have a final action plan by August or September, which it can present to lawmakers and businesses. At the end of the meeting, advocates discussed ways to make sure as many locals as possible took the survey, including paper copy versions for people with no internet at all. But with residents in the Tri-County spread over vast and mountainous terrain, just contacting some residents at all could be a challenge. Peggy O'Brien, the local government's manager for the Rio Grande COG, compared the challenges to those faced by local officials while working on the 2020 census. It's like the state of Rhode Island in terms of the mileage, she said. There were ranches in Jeff Davis County that were 30 miles from the gate. New top cop in Presidio says family tragedy informs his style of policing. By Stephen Paulson. The city of Presidio has a new police chief. At a city meeting last month, council voted to appoint Margarito Hernandez, an officer with around 20 years' experience in law enforcement. The role was previously filled by Jose Cabby Cabezuela, but after 15 years serving in the Presidio Police Department, Cabezuela stepped down at the end of January to spend more time with his father at the family's ranch near Candelaria, as the Big Bend Sentinel previously reported. After hearing news of Cabezuela's resignation, John Ferguson, the mayor of Presidio, appointed Hernandez as an interim chief. In an interview at the time, Ferguson thanked Cabezuela for service to Presidio and said residents were sad to see him go. I feel like he was a good face for the police department, an experienced lawman and a good people person, Ferguson added. I want to wish him well and thank him for his service to Presidio. That interim appointment became official around 2 weeks later, when Presidio City Council voted to make Hernandez's new position permanent. In a statement of his own, Cabezuela congratulated the new police chief. I just want to wish him good luck and to congratulate him for being given the opportunity to serve as chief of police, Cabezuela said. I know it's a great honor to be able to serve your community as a high-ranking police officer. Best of luck, Margarito. Prior to Cabezuela's retirement, Hernandez had served as Cabezuela's second-in-command, as a sergeant with the Presidio PD, but his background in law enforcement goes back far before that, to the 1990s. After several years of doing agricultural and oil field jobs, Hernandez took his first law enforcement job in around 1997, at the age of 28. He started as a jailer with the Presidio County Sheriff's Office. Around a year later, in 1998, he was promoted to deputy. In those days, Hernandez recalled, it felt like there was less of a law enforcement presence in the region. As a deputy, he was tasked with responding to calls across the vast and rugged terrain of Presidio County. I rarely saw the Department of Public Safety, Border Patrol, game wardens, and all that stuff, he said. And the county's pretty big. He covered an area all along the borderlands of Presidio County, from Lajitas to Candelaria. That job continued until around 2003, when a position opened up at the newly formed Presidio Police Department. Hernandez decided to apply. He grew up in Redford, he explained, and went to Presidio High School. The idea of working as a cop in his hometown appealed to him. I've always liked to help people, he added. As for the residents of Presidio, you can get along easy with them. There aren't any big problems. Growing up, Hernandez always wanted to be a police officer. When I was young, that was one of my dreams, he said, to become law enforcement. But in 1997, right around when Hernandez was starting off in law enforcement, his family experienced a tragedy that might have caused others to question those dreams. His younger brother, Ezequiel, then just 18, was herding goats near the border when he came across U.S. Marines who were conducting an operation to prevent drug smugglers.
One of the Marines shot and killed Ezekiel, who they accused of allegedly pointing a gun at them. It was the first shooting of an American civilian by the U.S. military since the Kent State shootings of 1970, and it prompted national headlines. A local prosecutor opened a murder investigation, and Congress also investigated the matter. But Clemente Bañuelos, the Marine who shot Ezekiel, was never charged. The incident caused decades of pain for the Hernandez family, Margarito recalled in an interview with the San Antonio Express News in 2017. There was no justice, Hernandez told the paper. My mom never came out of shock. She never recovered. Asked in an interview with the Big Bend Sentinel whether the tragedy caused him to doubt his career dreams, Margarito said no. Instead, he said, it made him want to do better. Some family members questioned his decisions, but Margarito said he told them, sometimes people are blamed for other people. People say police are bad, Margarito said, recalling those discussions. But as he saw it, the only bad person in wrongful police shootings is the person who makes the decision to take somebody's life. It's perhaps no coincidence, then, that Margarito says he's a big fan of community-oriented policing. A philosophy that's grown in popularity in recent years, community policing focuses on building relationships with communities and keeping people safe over action movie portrayals of law enforcement. I've always liked to help people, Margarito said. I'm always conscious that the community pays my salary. I work for Presidio. He says he tries to carry that philosophy into his day-to-day police work. Good policing, he said, should follow the golden rule. Put yourself in another person's shoes, Margarito explained, and treat that person how you'd like to be treated.
Local officials express doubt as Texas governor announces end to COVID restrictions. By Abby Peralt. Governor Greg Abbott on Tuesday announced his plan to end the mask mandate and lift all restrictions on businesses, restaurants, and bars beginning March 10th. The move comes 1 year into the worldwide coronavirus pandemic, as Texas lags behind almost all other states in vaccinating its residents against the deadly COVID-19 disease. Hours after the governor's announcement, Texas reported 271 additional Texans dead from COVID-19. Presidio County Judge Cinderella Guevara said that while the governor's latest move sounded positive and like Texas was headed in the right direction, she stressed there's no facts behind it, no medical data behind it. City of Presidio Mayor John Ferguson called the governor's actions unwise, writing on social media, it's too early and lives may be unnecessarily put at risk. Governor Abbott will continue to allow businesses to impose their own restrictions about capacity or safety, but said in his press conference that state mandates are no longer needed. While more vaccines are on the way with an authorization on the latest one-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine, Guevara said it was too soon to lift statewide orders. What if that causes a new surge of the disease to be spread when we're just now more or less controlling it with the safety measures, she asked. Abbott once again tied the hands of local leaders, mostly preventing them from putting orders in place in their own communities. Cities and counties are only able to impose COVID-19 restrictions if hospitals in the region's trauma service area hit 15% of their capacity with COVID patients for 7 days straight. Even then, businesses still have to be able to operate with at least 50% capacity. Municipalities cannot impose jail time for violations of their rules, and there cannot be penalties for failure to wear a mask. We haven't even finished vaccinating the 1B population. We haven't gone on to the regular population, so it's hard to understand his reasoning to go ahead and undo the mask mandate, Guevara said. DSHS Associate Commissioner Imelda Garcia last week encouraged all vaccine providers to stick to vaccinating only 1A and 1B groups. Nevertheless, some are now offering shots on a first-come, first-served basis, asking few questions or explicitly announcing they will vaccinate anyone. Scenic Mountain Medical Center in Big Spring, northeast of Midland, shared on their website, although the priorities are currently listed as Phase 1A and Phase 1B, we will not turn away anyone that shows up for the vaccine. According to data provided by the Department of State Health Services, only 8.9% of Texans over 16 have been fully vaccinated with two doses as of Tuesday. The state has given first dose COVID vaccinations to 16.5% of its residents aged 16 and older, leaving Texas trailing behind almost every other state in the country. While counties are struggling to access the amount of vaccines their residents demand, vaccination rates in Presidio County have steadily increased in the past month. Preventative Care Health Services CEO Linda Molinar, who runs clinics in Alpine, Presidio, and Marfa, said her clinic has a list of 2,000 individuals who are still wanting to be vaccinated among Presidio and Brewster counties, with 100 calling to get on the list just this weekend. PCHS vaccinated 1,000 exactly in the past week, just in the city of Presidio, she said, counting first and second doses. The state estimates 5,069 people in Presidio County are over 16, and since the vaccine is only approved for those over that age, 5,069 is the target to reach to fully vaccinate the area. In data from the state on Tuesday, 2,273 Presidio County residents have gotten their first shot, which is 44.8% of the county's estimated 16-plus population. When compared to Texas's 253 other counties, Presidio County has outpaced every other one, vaccinating the highest percent of its 16-plus population. That calculation favors smaller counties. The number of shots required to vaccinate 1% of 3.6 million eligible Harris County residents versus 1% of 5,069 eligible Presidio County residents, but Presidio County has still outpaced dozens of smaller counties in vaccinating its population. It's good news for Presidio County residents, who statistically skew more elderly than other parts of Texas, have more health risk, and have less access to nearby high-level healthcare. Certain large shipments of the vaccine likely helped get the county to where it is today. Among other smaller shipments through the past few months, two batches of 500 first doses arrived at DSHS Marfa last week. And in February, Midland Memorial Hospital sent batches of 400 and then 600 doses to PCHS in the city of Presidio and brought 500 doses to the USO building in Marfa last month, among other shipments of vaccine doses to Presidio County clinics. Some of those shots delivered to Presidio County went to non-local residents who traveled from Terlingua Alpine, Fort Davis, Valentine, or elsewhere to get the shot in Presidio County. But likewise, Presidio County residents have also traveled far and wide across West Texas to get a vaccine. Along with first-round vaccine data, the number of second-round vaccines in the area is rising as well. On Tuesday, 797 Presidio County residents were fully vaccinated, meaning 15.72% of the county's estimated 16-plus population. That's more than double Texas's vaccination rate. To date, the state has fully vaccinated only 6.9% of its 16-plus population. Even if Texans were fully vaccinated or vaccinated enough to build herd immunity against a pandemic that has ravaged the United States, the CDC at this time is asking people who are vaccinated to continue to maintain physical distance from individuals outside their household, avoid crowds, and wear a mask. The orders lifted by Governor Abbott undo some of the exact mandates that keep Texans in line with CDC guidelines. In its place, the governor instead asked Texans to use personal responsibility. "I can't supersede the governor's orders," Judge Guevara said, "but I would still encourage and highly recommend people continue to wear their mask and stay a safe distance of 6 feet apart until we see for ourselves that percentage-wise, most everyone has been vaccinated."
IRS delays tax filing deadlines for all Texans by Big Ben Sentinel. Victims of winter storms that began February 11, 2021, now have until June 15, 2021 to file various individual and business tax returns and make tax payments, the Internal Revenue Service announced last week. Following the recent disaster declaration issued by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the IRS announced last week that affected taxpayers will receive tax relief. Individuals and households affected by severe winter storms that reside or have a business in all 254 Texas counties qualify for tax relief. The declaration permits the IRS to postpone certain tax filing and tax payment deadlines for taxpayers who reside or have a business in the disaster area. For instance, certain deadlines falling on or after February 11, 2021 and before June 15, 2021 are postponed through June 15th. This includes various 2020 business tax returns due on March 15th and 2020 individual and business returns due on April 15th. Taxpayers also have until June 15th to make 2020 IRA contributions. The June 15th deadline applies to the fourth quarter estimated tax payment due on April 15th. It also applies to the quarterly payroll and excise tax returns normally due on April 30th, 2021. In addition, it applies to tax-exempt organizations operating on a calendar year basis that have a 2020 return due on May 17th, 2021. In addition, penalties on deposits due on or after February 11th, 2021 and before February 26th, 2021 will be abated as long as the tax deposits were made by February 26th. If an affected taxpayer receives a late filing or late payment penalty notice from the IRS that has an original or extended filing, payment or deposit due date that falls within the postponement period, the taxpayer should call the telephone number on the notice to have the IRS abate the penalty. For information on services currently available, visit the IRS Operations and Services page at irs.gov/coronavirus. The IRS automatically identifies taxpayers located in the covered disaster area and applies filing and payment relief. Affected taxpayers that have an estimated income tax payment originally due on or after February 11th and before June 15th are postponed through June 15th and will not be subject to penalties for failure to pay estimated tax installments as long as such payments are paid on or before June 15th. The IRS will waive the usual fees and request for copies of previously filed tax returns for affected taxpayers. Taxpayers should put the assigned disaster designation, Texas Severe Winter Storms, in bold letters at the top of Form 4506, Request for Copy of Tax Return PDF, or Form 4506T, Request for Transcript of Tax Return PDF, as appropriate, and submit it to the IRS. Affected taxpayers who are contacted by the IRS on a collection or examination matter should explain how the disaster impacts them so that the IRS can provide appropriate consideration to their case. Taxpayers may download forms and publications from the official IRS website, irs.gov. High Desert Sketches: No Regulation Means a Very Dangerous Climate, by George A. Covington. Tim Boyd, mayor of Colorado City, Texas, expressed to the world his feelings on what a true Texan should accept when it comes to adversity. "No one owes you or your family anything," Tim Boyd wrote on a Tuesday in a now-deleted Facebook post, according to KTXS and KTAB KRBC. Boyd added, "I'm sick and tired of people looking for a damn handout." Boyd stated firmly that municipal governments or utility companies had no obligation to provide paying customers with necessities like heat and running water during our catastrophic winter storm. With echoes of a recent former president, he stated, "Only the strong will survive and the weak will perish," he wrote. He further categorized those people who were just sitting at home and doing nothing to save themselves were lazy. "Folks, God has given us the tools to support ourselves in times like this," he wrote, claiming that those who expected the city to come to their aid were sadly a product of a socialist government. "I predict that Mayor Boyd will rally the forces of former President Tweet and his teabagger party and run for governor of Texas." U.S. Senator Rafael Edward Ted Cruz, invoked the legend of Pecos Bill, is rumored to have gone to the resort in Cancun to lasso the sun and bring it back to Texas. Legend has it that Pecos Bill once lassoed and rode a tornado, so Cruz had to do him one better. It didn't work, but then most of the time, neither does the U.S. Senate. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, one of the notorious Amigo Egos, also fled the state but claimed he had to have a serious meeting about legal matters with the Attorney General of Utah. When asked why he couldn't have a virtual meeting instead of taking thousands of taxpayer dollars to visit Utah, he had no comment. "I assume that because he had fired most of his top staff after they accused him of profiting from his office, that he was recruiting personnel." The Electric Reliability Council of Texas, ERCOT, manages the flow of electric power to more than 26 million Texas customers, representing about 90% of the state's electric load. The Texas Reliability Entity, TRE, was created to assure that ERCOT followed the procedures established to guarantee the flow of electricity throughout Texas. It was discovered that a month or so before the blizzard hit, that the governor abolished the oversight agency, TRE, by firing all its employees. The news media had pointed out that at least five of the ERCOT board members lived out of state, make $100,000 a year for doing almost nothing, and at least one of them lived in Germany. The media had also pointed out that at least five of the board members have resigned. I would hope that the media would ask them how much they donated to the last election of the three amigo egos, the governor, the lieutenant governor, and attorney general. The mayor of Colorado City, Texas, and our junior U.S. senator do not represent the spirit that has made our great state. The person who does represent the spirit is Ryan Sively. Jill Ventimiglia of Austin found herself stuck on an icy road with 30 other cars stranded. There was no cell service to call for help. After 15 minutes of frantically calling for help, a stranger shouted to her, "The guy is coming to get you next." It was Sively in his pickup truck, which he lovingly calls the Beast. Sively rescued 98 drivers on Monday and about 400 others during the brutal blast that has hammered Texas. He said, "Frigid temperatures and relentless snowstorms have sparked water and food shortages, widespread power outages, and hazardous ice-glazed roadways."
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, February 25th. Normal temps return to area. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. A second round of winter storms dropped another 4 to 6 inches of snow last Thursday as temperatures continued well below freezing. Perhaps not as severe as the earlier round, temperatures still hovered in the mid-teens to low 20s. The snow began early Thursday morning and continued through most of the day. Temperatures continued to drop, reaching a low of 10 degrees on Friday morning before finally giving way to sunshine on Friday afternoon, warming to the mid-40s. Overall, through this winter storm, temperatures were below freezing for 10 days, something that is virtually unheard of in Texas. Total snowfall for the 10 days of freezing weather was well over 12 inches in most areas of the Permian Basin. Most of the state experienced temperatures below freezing for extended periods of time. But road conditions remained dangerous as the melted snow refroze on local roads and Interstate 20 Thursday night into Friday morning. A few minor traffic accidents were reported on Interstate 20, but the ice began to melt on Friday evening, giving way to temperatures in the low 60s on Saturday. Locally, Monahans Police Department Captain Christopher Quintana reported a few minor accidents on Thursday into Friday due to hazardous road conditions, but no major accidents. As the weather warmed up and pipes began to thaw, broken pipes became evident as the water lines thawed. People searching for needed repair parts flooded local hardware stores. Ace Hardware, Simply Home, and Mitchell's Thrift Mart in Monahans, and Main Street Market in Wicket all had a difficult time keeping needed pipes and fittings in stock. Aisles were also crammed with people looking for pipe and parts at Home Depot and Lowe's Home Improvement in Odessa. Grocery stores also had a hard time keeping many food items in stock as deliveries were hampered by the inclement weather and patrons storming the shelves for items such as milk, bread, water, and meat. Shelves at Lowe's Marketplace, as well as stores in Odessa, had bare shelves of those items. Power outages were also prevalent throughout the area, as ERCOT, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, had issues trying to keep the grid running as power plants shut down because of the freezing temperatures. Rolling outages, and many were without power for several days. The power grid was finally back online by Friday, and most people had power restored. The ERCOT issues has prompted a firestorm of legislators, including local state representative Brooks Landgraf, heading up investigations into the causes of the ERCOT grid failures. The Public Utilities Commission also threatened to increase electricity rates to help defray the increased costs of producing electricity. That action is also being challenged, with Governor Greg Abbott taking a strong stance against such measures. Suspects still sought in Saturday's armed robbery. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. The Monahans Police Department is seeking information about an armed robbery of Microtel Inn and Suites last Saturday afternoon. With the help of surveillance cameras, the suspect has been identified as Braden Ray Stout, age 20, of Monahans. According to MPD Captain Christopher Quintana, on Saturday, February 21st, at approximately 4:11 p.m., Monahans Police Department officers were dispatched to the Microtel Inn and Suites located at 813 Northwest I-20 Service Road in reference to a robbery. The preliminary investigation showed a white male displayed a firearm, threatened, and stole U.S. currency from a Hispanic female victim. The white male exited the hotel and fled the scene. An arrest warrant was issued for Stout, charging him with aggravated robbery with a deadly weapon, a first-degree felony. The Monahans Police Department is asking for any information as to the whereabouts of Stout. You may call the Monahans Police Department at area code 432-943-3254 or the Ward County Crime Stoppers at 432-943-TIPS. Steen throws hat in the ring for mayoral race. New sandwich shop to open. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Monahans voters will have a contested mayoral race to decide this May. Incumbent David Cutberth filed his intent for re-election, while challenger Adam Steen, a Monahans resident, also filed a petition for the seat, City Manager Rex C. told council members during their regularly scheduled meeting on Tuesday. The election for council positions 2 and 3 were both canceled since both positions remain unopposed. Jeppy Wilson has occupied the District 2 seat for 24 years, while Calvin Carroll won the District 3 seat in May 2019. Mayoral elections are held every 2 years, and Cutberth has not had a competitor since T.J. Price ran for the post in 2017. Mayor David Cutberth has been in office for 28 years. The election will be held on Saturday, May 1st, at the Monahans Wicket Pyote Administration Building, located at 606 South Betty Street, from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Early voting will be held April 19th through 23rd at the City Hall City Council Chambers, located at 112 West 2nd Street, from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Nancy Upchurch was appointed as election judge for the upcoming election, with Laura Beharan serving as alternate. In other city council business, a public hearing was held to remove Lot 6, all of Lot 7, 8, 9 of Block 9 in Monahans Original Town Edition, which is at 408 West Seeley Street, from the fire zone. Thee told the council the reason for the request of the removal was to put a temporary building on the lot to open a sandwich shop. If the restaurant proves successful, the petitioner, Ruben Arroyo, stated the possibility of building a permanent building on the lot. Even though members of the public were present for the hearing, no one had any comments on the request. Since the public hearing yielded no remarks from the public on the removal of 408 West Seeley from the fire zone, the first reading of the ordinance removing those lots was approved by the council. A second reading will be required before Arroyo can proceed with plans for the lot. In regular business, two parade permit requests were approved. The first is for the graduating class of 2021 and will be held on May 24th at 8 p.m. Quote, "This is something that started last year for the class of 2020 during the height of the pandemic, but Principal Patty Acosta would like to keep this as a yearly tradition for the seniors," Chamber of Commerce Director Teresa Burnett said. The parade will start at the high school, head north to Seeley, then east to the Million Barrel parking lot, where pictures of the seniors will be taken. The second request was for the annual Freedom Fest parade to be held on July 3rd, beginning at 9 a.m. Going along with the previous agenda item, the council approved a request from Burnett to close 5 Street between Allen and Calvin Streets from noon July 2nd through 5 p.m. on July 3rd for the annual Freedom Fest. Quote, "We are planning to go ahead with the Freedom Fest for this year. We have put some guidelines in place to help with controlling the spread of germs and to help with social distancing," Burnett said. The next city council meeting will be held at 3 p.m. on Tuesday, March 9th, in council chambers at City Hall at 112 West 2nd Street. COVID cases down in county, state. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. The number of active COVID-19 cases continues to drop not only in Ward County, but across the state. As of Wednesday morning, County Judge Greg Holly reported there were 60 active cases, 645 confirmed cases, 463 probable, 1,028 recoveries, and 20 deaths. A week ago, there were 69 cases. There has not been any more documented deaths since February 12th. The active case count in the state is also decreasing, with 192,000, which is down by over 93,000 since February 12th. Currently, there are 2.2 million confirmed cases across the state, with 346,000 probable cases and 41,640 deaths attributed to the virus. In a post earlier in the week, Holly said he had occasionally been chastised, usually privately, for not taking a stronger stance toward enforcing state and federal guidelines. That prompted him to do some calculations to compare COVID statistics to other areas across the state. Quote, "At the state level, I found that almost exactly 9% of each sampled state population was known to have been infected with the virus so far. At the Texas county level, I found a wider variation, but still found percentages generally within the range of 8 to 10%. At the state level, I found that about 1.5 to 2% of those infected are shown as fatalities. New York was a notable exception at 2.9%. At the Texas county level, I again found the range to generally fall within the range of 1.5 to 2%. Ward County is right in line with these findings, 9.5% of the population having been infected, and 1.8% of those infected being shown as fatalities, he said. He continues to encourage people to follow state and federal guidelines, but, quote, "I don't think we should make criminals out of otherwise law-abiding citizens," end quote. Distribution of the COVID-19 vaccine is now being distributed in the county in large numbers. Counting 500 doses given on Wednesday and 300 on Tuesday, the total is approximately 1,350 first doses and 250 second doses. The vaccines given on Tuesday and Wednesday, given at the Ward County Coliseum, were manufactured by Pfizer, which has very stringent requirements for the vaccine to be stored at a very cold temperature. Parents, students address school board with concerns over dress and grooming policy. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. Concerns about the dress code of Monahans Wicked Pyote ISD dominated Monday's meeting of the Board of Trustees as parents and students voiced their opinions. No actions were taken on the presentations, but the trustees did acknowledge the concerns. During the public comment time of the agenda, a Monahans High School student, a Sudirth Elementary student, and two parents addressed the trustees, stating their concerns. Later in the meeting, a Level 2 grievance hearing brought by Desiree Valle was heard. The common theme to all of the comments was disagreement with the current dress code policy. Kaylana Valle, a freshman daughter of Desiree Valle, was the first to address the board. Quote, I am here to speak about how your dress code is discriminatory. I have listened to my mother and father and helped my brother get through this. The Monahan School is so unfair. You single out certain kids, and the majority of the kids don't get singled out are those with parents who have money or connections. She went on to discuss alleged harassment when MWP ISD Police Chief Orlando Orona visited their home and reportedly advised them to drop the complaints of discrimination. Orona has denied the comments. Fourth grade student Koa Valle, younger brother of Kaylana, then addressed the trustees. Koa discussed the family heritage of growing long hair. He had his hair cut on the sides, but not the top. His mother was told if we could do that, then we could cut all of his hair. Quote, "What does my hair length have to do with being clean? Honestly, since I was forced to cut my hair, we no longer style it or fix it. What's the point? I don't want to look like all of you. I want to look and be like myself. Making me cut my hair to fit your idea of what I should look like was wrong. Sending a police officer to my home was scary and terrifying," he said. Rebecca Kynes was the next to address the trustees under the public comment item on the agenda. Kynes had attended a Level 3 grievance hearing last November. Quote, "I am disappointed to find myself before you all again today. According to policy, if no response is received during a Level 3 hearing, the default ruling is the Level 2 ruling. This is a cowardly policy, and I feel written with the intent of wasting your time and my time by forcing hearings with people who can't or won't make a decision, followed lastly with a hearing in front of a board that can't or won't make a decision," she said. She went on to reference an email sent by Trustee Nancy Upchurch after her November hearing. She alleged there was a great deal of misinformation in the email. The referenced email, which was also sent to the publisher Smokey Briggs at the Monahan's News on November 20th, Upchurch said, quote, "The board is not going to change the dress code in the middle of a year. We will review the policy and act upon changes if and as needed when board policies are reviewed, which will not be until the end of the next school year unless we are forced to by the government," end quote. The concluding comments were by Carla Davis. After reviewing her credentials in child psychology and having over 16 years of experience in the field, she said, quote, "We need to let them, the kids, be who they are and help them be themselves. We are not asking to do away with the dress code. We need a policy that does not discriminate on race, religion, culture, or gender. Let's have a code that keeps these rights," end quote. Kynes and Davis both have children enrolled in MWP ISD. After the conclusion of most other agenda items, Desiree Valle had her Level 3 grievance hearing in open session to the board. She opened her comments regarding the haircut issue with her son Kia Koa, reference to Koa earlier, in which his long hair is his tradition and belief on when it should be cut. Quote, "The beliefs he has regarding his ancestry are his and his alone. They are not for you to decide," she said. "We do not believe this district and its officials are aware of what this dress code does to our children and their self-esteem," end quote. Since she started the grievance process, he was constantly told for weeks that his hair was going to get him suspended, or ISS, in school suspension. No one reached out to Valle, she said. She also alleged that Sudhir principal Kim Thomas thought it was right to send school police chief Orona to her home to threaten them. Quote, "The conversation was never recorded by their officer, so it is a he said, she said situation, but there was a threat of not being able to attend any awards given to my son, or just to drop him off. I wouldn't have been allowed to step foot on school grounds for this year or next." End quote. Quote, "I also want to bring in the fact that you all have stated that the dress code cannot be changed immediately or have the hair code just dropped. But yet, when the high school wanted to have students empty their pockets before entering a restroom, the school administration discovered it may not be legal and dropped the rule. My question for this is why keep ignoring what is presented in front of you," she continued. She also reviewed the Title IX policies for any school that receives federal funding. Quote, "Title IX of the federal code states, no person in the U.S. shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any educational program or activity receiving federal assistance." She concluded with the following questions. Will you change the dress code to meet the standards the federal government has laid before you? Will the grievance process become more transparent with the parents of the students who attend here? Are we all going to come together to make MWP ISD succeed? School Superintendent Chad Smith was then allowed to make comments to conclude the grievance hearing. Quote, "The board creates policy. I work for the board and follow policy to the best of my ability. There will be a committee this spring to address the dress code. That's all I have to say." End quote. The other items of the school board meeting will be included in next week's edition of the news.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.